Welcome to Florida and St. Petersburg.
Absolutely. This episode of Welcome to Florida is all about the St. Pete Pier, opened in the summer of 2020, an entirely new destination for the state of Florida, and one you are going to want to go out of your way to visit. It is not the old St. Pete Pier where Craig Pittman got married. What?
Yes, that's true. It's true. Well, okay, think about it. My wife and I were both working for the what was then the St. Petersburg Times. Uh-huh. We were thinking, where's a good place to get married? A good place for two journalists to get married. It's an inverted pyramid, because you write in the inverted pyramid style with the most important facts at the top and the less ones at the bottom. So there was the Columbia restaurant had a restaurant inside the pier. So we worked with them. They had an event space that was a separate level of the pier. So we worked with them to set up the wedding in that event space. They catered the wedding, and it took place right at sunset. So we had the setting sun visible to all the guests, and everything went great, even though we nearly set one of the bridesmaids her hair on fire during the picture taking. But that's, you know what they say. If at the end of the day, the bride and the groom are married, it's a successful wedding.
Yes, absolutely. Well, with all deference to the Pittman wedding, the new St. Pete Pier is light year step forward in design, architecture, programming, functionality. It is
environmental sensitivity. Yeah.
It has through the design and envisioning phase, it went from a pier to a 26-acre park adjacent to Tampa Bay for biking, walking, dining, cocktails, shopping, swimming, concerts, all open to the public, all free of charge. You've got public art, marketplace with independent vendors, splash pads, and a playground for kids, family, parks and picnic areas, a fishing deck. It is really a multi-use destination that anyone visiting the Tampa St. Pete area and really Florida generally should go out of their way to see. It is one of the great public works, tourist destination, lifestyle, livability projects completed in the entire country in the last 10 or 15 years. It is that good and has received reviews that favorable. It is the most iconic spot in St. Petersburg. And we are joined by Raul Quintana, who worked on the project through thick and thin for 12 years, planning, design, project management, fits and starts, and he's going to tell us
public outrage and going back to the beginning. Yes,
which had its part, and that it really has a fascinating story going back over a century. But the St. Pete Pier you see today was a long drawn out wrestling match, but all of that effort and tireless work was worth it, because the St. Pete Pier is one of the top destinations in Florida, and we're going to learn all about how it came to be.
Raul, St. Petersburg is a city that really values the public part of its waterfront. There's been a long history of having a pier structure there, is there not?
Well, there's been a pier here since the late 1800s. And at some point, there's probably been about seven or eight piers in different iterations and forms throughout the history of the city.
The new St. Petersburg Pier debuted in the summer of 2020. The old pier is the upside down pyramid that so many people remember and where Craig got married. Why was the decision made to, instead of renovating that, remodeling it, refurbishing, just start from scratch?
So that's a great question. Fundamentally, the building that was out there, the inverted pyramid, there was really nothing structurally wrong with it. I mean, it could have been renovated. It could have been part of the process, but the bridge and the superstructure that was surrounding that inverted pyramid and that had all the traffic and the vehicles was almost 90 years old. And it has had serious issues almost from the time that it was built. Very short, because I did a lot of research in this, and I found that very shortly after it was constructed, probably in the 30s, the city engineering department started to look at the underside of that structure and began to deal with the maintenance of it, because it's in a harsh environment, severe weather, salt water, technology and materials aren't today what they were, you know, 90 years ago. They were really not up to what we have today. The structure, that bridge, that superstructure had significant issues with it. And in 2005, there was an engineering report that said that you really only have about 10 years of service life left. You have to do something about that bridge. And that's what became the beginning of this process. And it wasn't until many years later that the city found some funding or came up with the funding plan out of the tax increment financing to renovate it or do something. You really didn't know what we were going to do. And from there, the series of visioning sessions with the community and led to a whole lot of other meetings. So the bottom line is the building at the end, the inverted pyramid, probably could have survived. I mean, it was built on its own foundation. It replaced the casino that was there from the 20s that didn't last beyond the early 60s. So the old Mediterranean style casino deteriorated in the environment, had to be replaced. The inverted pyramid was built in 73, I believe, and it was way ahead of its time. At the time that it was built, I think I've read back in some of the newspaper articles that the community didn't like it at first. So it was an odd building, but it was a well-designed and thought through building in terms of what they had to work with, because they did not want to impact that bridge, that foundation. So they minimized the impact on the ground floor, and each subsequent floor had more space. So that kind of formed that pyramid. So that building had its ups and downs, and probably within 5 or 6 years, I think the city knew by the early 80s that it had some functionality issues. And so in the mid 80s, they added about $12 million to it and created this festival marketplace around that first level of the pier, which is what was there essentially up until the day that we closed it. So a lot of issues with that building, but that really wasn't the reason that this project was formed and the reason we took on this challenge of replacing it.
So what were some of the challenges and that you faced in trying to build a new pier, a non-inverted pyramid pier?
So challenge number one was the community. And, this is something that not, you know, I guess a lot of cities do go through this, but we hadn't. This is the pier is our landmark, has been our landmark for, you know, by the time we took this issue on 80, 90 years.
Yeah, and it's like change, the Arch in St. Louis. Yeah,
like the Arch in St. Louis or, the Opera House in Sydney. What happens to a community when you have to replace its landmark? And to me, that's what this was all about. And it's the process of public engagement and opening our minds to what the possibilities could be. And just going through that's very onerous, very time consuming process of understanding how do we do this and what do we replace it with and do we renovate it? So that was a major, major challenge. It took many, many years to unfold, and it crossed over three mayoral terms. We really had a lot of stops and starts, and we really, by the time we came to the conclusion that, you know, with the final design, we had gone through almost 6 years of effort and spent a lot of money. Mm-hmm. With the first, as you know, I don't know if you do know, but there was a previous effort in about 2011, 2012. We went out with an international design competition. There was a solution called the Lens, and that the community basically told us to not go forward with it.
Yeah, they didn't like it. They didn't like it.
Stop the Lens. It was a referendum. And, and we learned a lot from that process. So the trials and tribulations of this project, getting it to where it is today, and the unbelievable success that it ultimately is today, is a long story. And I know we only have a few minutes here, so...
I mean, that is important. It's important work to do, obviously, because this is for the public. It's not for architects. You know, it's not for designers to prove what sort of interesting materials they can use and how they can, you know, push forward the construction industry. This is
for a politician to brag, hey, look what I built.
For people. And if the people, they need to want to use it. And quite obviously, they do.
Yeah. So we had to get it right. And getting it right from the beginning, you know, the very first thing you do, you go out to the community and you say, well, what do you want to see? So we did that. We did that in 2008. There was a series of visioning sessions. And what came out of it was just, you know, a lot of ideas. And actually, I still have it to this day. I have a file on my computer called Wacky Ideas.
Okay. So what were some of the wacky ideas? I got to ask.
You know, Ferris wheels and
roller coasters.
You know, roller coasters and buildings with minarets over them. I mean, just, you know, go back to, so there's a whole lot of seashells. I mean, there was a lot of fun in that, and a lot. But what came out of that was really interesting, because what we learned was that the community did not want to lose its pier. The option of not having a pier was the real issue. I mean, we had to figure out, well, what is it going to be is not as important as, you know, that we have a pier. But nobody knew what it was going to be. So when you have something for so long and you grow up with it and your entire life is this one thing, it's a destination at the end of a bridge. That's what you seem to go towards. That's the only thing that you can visualize. Mm-hmm. It's what you've grown up with, and it's what the community kept thinking that they wanted and they had to have. So there was a task force in 2009. Task force spent almost a year working as a group of about 30 or 40 individuals around the city, different backgrounds and experience. And they had 64 public meetings. Wow. They broke into committees. They evaluated every inch of this, and they developed a report. And that report had some programmatic things that they looked at, but they also looked at a couple of options in terms of, you know, how far out the pier should be, how wide it should be. They were very prescriptive. And the concern I always had is, you know, why would we want to prescribe something to someone? That sort of closes the door on ideas. And let's think about what some other things we can have out here. Mm. Let's just not, you know, limit ourselves. But what also came out of that report was that the city should do an international design competition. And I could tell you, I look back and I could never find where the city had ever done anything like that. No one in my office had done it. I kind of, you know, stumbled around with this whole notion of how do you do one. So we began to dig into it. We began to see, well, what have other cities done? One that we did look at was the St. Louis Arch in St. Louis, which had been doing a major international design competition for the area around it. And so we modeled some of it after that, and we put together, a process. We put together a jury. We did everything right, you know, according to the rules of, you know, AIA's guidelines for national design competitions, and we went out into the street. This was in 2011, and we were blown away. We received 26 submissions from some of the most phenomenal architects in the world. We had no idea. And this project really touched on a nerve in the design community. They understood the potential of something like this. You don't do projects like this. There's a reason for it. Mm-hmm. No one builds piers anymore. And fundamentally, it's environmentally difficult to permit. The climate of building a pier over water, it has to have a purpose. And the fact that we have always had a pier, I think is a reason we're able to do it. And for communities that, you know, they live along the water, they don't have a pier, they're not going to go out and build one. So this became a successful outreach to the world of architects. And we were looking like, you know, this is really good. We had five really good jurors across, you know, there's local representation and representation from a significant architect, Stanley Sadowitz. He had just designed the Tampa Museum of Arts. He was on the jury. And there was a short list. It was a short list of three firms. And then we paid a stipend, and they came back after about, you know, a couple months worth of work with the concepts. And the unveiling of the concept, the whole world exploded. So with that's when we first saw Michael Maltzen's lens, which we worked really hard to try to make happen. We spent a lot of money on it, but the community just did not embrace it. There was significant opposition to it for a number of probably some really good reasons, actually. It was way ahead of its time, and it didn't do the things that the community really wanted to do. And so we got obliterated, both Chris and I. We took it pretty hard because we spent a lot of time and effort trying to make it work and get it, you know, through some level of design and, you know, pricing it, and making sure that it was going to be in budget. We had a very tight budget for this whole project. And at the end of the day, the vote was overwhelming. So we had to kind of step back, lick our wounds, and move forward. At the same time, there was a mayoral election, and we got a new mayor, Mayor Rick Kreisman and his team, and he came in, full bore on this. At the time, the pier was closed because we decided to close the pier, and there was a fence around it, and it was not a good situation.
No,
we had to start over, and yeah. Starting over, my recommendation, I think, to Mayor Kreisman was, let's not do another competition. Let's pick an architect. Let's design this from ground up. But no, he wanted more ideas. He did not want to limit us. He wanted not three shortlists, but he wanted eight. So he wanted to go back to the world of architects and get, other ideas. And he threw a twist. This time he said, well, the inverted pyramid is in the mix. Because the previous city council and mayor said, no, we're not considering the inverted pyramid, all new concepts. And that was the fundamental decision on his part that could have gone either way. I mean, this time around, my other concern was, after what had happened to Michael Molson, would we even get any interest at all? Would the world of architects want to do any work for the city of St. Petersburg after what happened to Mr. Molson? And that was very, very unfortunate. He's an amazing man. It was a talent, as you know, the most talented architect that I've ever worked with, practically. And we were concerned. So we ended up going back out, completely different international design competition process, different setup with a different jury, all local experts in a variety of skills. And we had the inverted pyramid as an option. Oh, and it was also, the mayor wanted the community to have a say in it. So there was going to be not a vote, but kind of almost like a straw poll. We had to figure out how that was going to work. And so we ended up with 16 proposals. And of the 16, he wanted eight. So the short listing was eight firms. Again, we went back, paid each a small stipend. They all came back with options. And of the eight, I think all but two had the inverted pyramid incorporated in some way, in some manner. And so we went through the process of evaluating them. There was a firm locally that got together with a team of architects, and they came up with a real interesting design to preserve the inverted pyramid. But it had some issues with it. They were going to perpetuate the driving over the pier. So it was all about the same kind of idea: drive your car out to the pier and walk into a building. And there were others that started to look at things differently. And at the end of the day, the five jurors that were selected really did an amazing job. I mean, if it wasn't for them, there was a meeting, I recall, that lasted like 13 hours. It was so contentious. Wow. The community came out, and there was a lot of angry, upset people. I mean, this is an important subject, but it's not the end of the world.
It's good that you had citizens that were so engaged in local issue. I mean, how often does that happen these days?
So much engagement in this. And what was interesting that came out of this other process is, all of a sudden, a lot of young people started coming out. And they started gravitating towards, there were two concepts that were more about active outdoor spaces. And both of them were led by New York-led teams, which was another thing that, in the original process, we kept hearing, well, we shouldn't ask outside architects to come into St. Pete. We know what we want. And I felt like that was so parochial, and that was such a bad way to look at this. We needed to broaden our vision. We really did. So the architects that came from around the world and even locally, there was a mixed group of ideas. Ultimately, the committee selected a project that kind of came out of the back of the field. It wasn't the forerunner that we thought. It was not that it was a compromise. It stood on its own, and the project was called Pier Park, and it was all about activating space and experiences. It was all about creating these sequences of experience as you go along this pier, which is not anything that this city has ever contemplated, because the previous pier was a bridge with a terminus at the end and parking lots along the approach and a big highway. And it was a roadway, and you could probably go out there on any single day and not see one person walking that approach to that pier. It just wasn't that way. But their idea was that you have to activate this entire length, mm-hmm. and that's what we should do. And that concept, that design, won the second competition. And immediately we negotiated an agreement, started working with them. And right off the bat, the budget was like double what we had were told that
how
we had a budget for.
So how much was it?
Well, our budget was $35 million for construction, and it came about double that. So we said, okay, we're not. So the beauty of the process, which I tried to explain to people, we weren't selecting a concept we were going to build. We were selecting a direction. We were selecting a way to go about solving this problem. And that direction led us to a concept that really programmatically and in its form and in the ideas that it had with it wasn't going to change. If we made things a little bit smaller, we had to reel it in. It was a much more robust project in its concept. It had many more features. It had floating platforms over the water. It was very event centric. Mm-hmm. The head of the pier had a magnificent lawn with a level which was just support spaces. And, you know, you could have put 3,000 or 4,000 people out at the end of the pier.
Oh, wow.
And we said, wait a minute, guys, we're not going to do that here. We have Vinoy Park. So the things that happen in a design competition, they're great because the architects are free to think and to create.
To imagine. Yeah.
They're imagined. They're not held. We gave them a program. We were specific about the things that we wanted to see in it. That's one of the things that Mayor Greisman felt really strongly about. We had to have programmatic elements that the community had embraced. So we gave them that. We gave them the parameters, you know, we gave them the budget, we gave them all those things, and they gave us the ideas. And I kept telling people, we're not going to build what we end up with. We're going to work towards that. And so that direction of a very experiential pier that, you know, people can enjoy and do different things, that was the essence of this design. And it was our job to figure out, okay, well, how do we actually build it within this budget and what is it going to be?
Yeah.
And we did not lose a single programmatic element. I mean, all the things that they came up with, except for the floating platforms, those immediately we said, look,
they floated away.
We're in Tampa Bay. We get massive storms. Do you really want, we could have done it. Yeah, sure. I knew it was permitted and everything else, but at the end of the day, the cost of doing it so that it would last and be robust enough that it would really work, it just wasn't in our budget. Maybe some other day, maybe in the future, those could be added to the project. And we did a lot for that. But the reality is that we didn't lose anything programmatically. The building at the end became a much smaller version of what they had conceived. You still have the lawn. You still have, you know, the observation and the views from the building in the end is really what the community wanted. And they wanted something to do. They wanted a place to eat, place to drink, place to fish. You wanted to be able to, you know, ride your bike. You wanted to be able to do all these things. And then as it comes out, you know, towards the land, there were other elements that we had programmatically. The community wanted something that the marine environment could get a hold of and really do something special with. Something environmental. So Tampa Bay Watch ended up being the tenant on it, and it became the Discovery Center.
Yeah.
And it's a place to learn about the bay and learn about all these other things. So the project grew in terms of, other team members and other components. We ended up adding a significant section as we were in the design of the, you know, the Pier Park portion, the portion over the water. Mayor Kreisman said, well, you know what, to do this right, we're going to have to connect to the city. Because originally the project, the $50 million project, was just a replacement of the pier. And that was, you know, 5 acres of overwater construction. It ended up becoming 26 acres. So it's a world-class major asset to the city. It's now a connector back to the downtown. Mm-hmm. It ties together the waterfront plan. It's more activities than even the original design team saw. And then we had to find a way to integrate that pier design with this the approach design. And because we're a public agency, we couldn't just, you know, hand that contract to the architect that was designing the pier over water. we had to go back out and resolicit design services, which we did, and a different architect won the contract for the land side. So we had to make sure that those two work seamlessly. We had to build it all at once. The funding got complicated because we had two contracts. We had two bond issuances to pay for this. The approach had a $20 million bond. The Pure River Water was a $40 million bond. All of it was paid for by the tax incremental financing that the county set up for projects like this in the downtown.
What's been the reception?
We kind of knew as we were putting this together, and you know, it took 3 years to build. So we began to see, as we were walking around and seeing it come together, we said, this is going to be amazing. This is going to be unbelievable. And it's the most visible project in the city. You can't miss it from anywhere around. But the public really didn't know what we were doing there. And as we started, you know, coming together, and we would take people out to, you know, to see it and explain it, we got the same reaction from everybody we talked to. Said, this is really amazing. I mean, and then when we opened it, and I was just blown away by the reception. People after people would say, I had no idea this is what you were doing. And they would look around, it's like all of a sudden something else landed in downtown St. Petersburg, because it wasn't the same pier. The sense of the old pier was completely gone, even though we kept elements of it, not a whole lot, but you know, the physical boundaries of the land side stayed the same. But the previous pier had no access to the water. You couldn't walk around it to the water. You couldn't, you know, there was no connectivity. So the cars were not the predominant any longer. So the environmental aspects of this pier are really important as well. To get our Army Corps of Engineer permit, we had to prove a net environmental benefit. And the way we did that was by eliminating cars over the bridge, reducing the number of piles, elevating the pier. So this pier is about 3.5 feet higher than the old pier, number of reasons, sea level rise being one, but also we now allow sunlight to come into the water, especially in the lower areas of the water, to allow the seagrasses to expand. And so the seagrasses have just been growing exponentially out there. So all of that, we reconstituted the beach, built a new beach entirely, reinforced all the seawalls, raised the seawalls, put in $6 million worth of infrastructure under the ground that you don't even see, fiber optics, new electric, new water and sewer, all of these components to make sure that the pier will last 100 years. Yeah. And it's flexible so that as other, you know, generations come along and they want to see things change, you can make changes. You can try to do different things. The fundamental portions of it, the structures, those are robust. Those aren't going to go anywhere. And we also didn't want this to be all about buildings. So there's four buildings, and the architecture of the buildings and the styles, they look utilitarian, but they're really not. They're very strong buildings. They're all post-tension concrete construction. The materiality of it is very consistent throughout. We looked at things like lighting. We didn't want lights to be overburdening on the project. We wanted the lights to be, you know, pointing down at the ground where you don't really see the lights. So the lighting plan was significant. Another major part of this is we really wanted families to appreciate this pier and come to the pier. And that's one thing that the other pier never had. We never had places for kids to come downtown St. Pete, families to really come down and hang out. So we wanted this to be an important destination. And we looked at the center of the pier on the land as being that place. So the combination of the tilted lawn, the splash pad, the pavilion in the middle where you can get a bite to eat. It's not going to, you know, break the bank. There's bathrooms. And then there's this magnificent playground that is a destination playground and the beach. So all of that, I know people that go out to the pier and only go there. They don't go anywhere else. They spend their entire day there, or they arrive early so they could camp out and grab an umbrella. So those were some of the things that we looked at. We planted over 700 trees. You would think, well, how did you get that? Well, we had to remove some trees. So I think there was maybe a net of 500, 550 trees. But we planted a lot of trees, and we planted trees that are native to St. Petersburg and to Florida. We planted a lot of pine trees. We planted flowering trees and palms. And so the landscape was a major part of this.
I'm going to stop you there because that's my favorite aspect. I never visited the old pier, but I did visit the new pier late 2020, early 2021. And as a member of the Florida Native Plant Society, of course, I was blown away by all of the native plants. And what I like so much is that the pier is the destination. It is not merely a means of accessing the destination. All along the pier, you talk about, you've got areas for biking and walking and dining and fishing off to the side, but it's this coastal thicket you incorporated into the design. It runs along the north side of the pier, and like you talked about, people can walk or bike through this oasis of Florida native plants, trees, shrubs. You've got the large trees providing shade, like the wax myrtle, myrtle oak, white buttonwood, but you've got the palms and the palmettos and the sea oats. It's ADA compliant, you know, and when I was going through, I was like, yes, you know, this is how you can incorporate a little bit of nature and landscaping into what is, you know, fundamentally a construction project. But I was blown away by, you know, how that, you know, reached me individually as a nature lover and a native plant lover. Where did that idea stem from and come together?
So that's a great segue, because I don't want to leave out the fact that we had some phenomenally brilliant designers on this project. Ken Smith, a landscape architect out of New York, that was his idea. He was a fundamental part of the team with Rob Rogers and ASD Sky out of Tampa. And
well, it's got that Highline New York feel to it.
It does. Mm-hmm. I mean, we would have never have thought of something like that. And as, in fact, when we saw it, you said, you know, I don't know that that's going to work. And they said, no, trust us. And we, you know, we felt like, you know, there was an opportunity there to do something really that would stand out. And they knocked it out of the park. The idea that you could take different pathways to the pier is fundamentally what they wanted to achieve. And one of the things that just blows me away every time I go out there is just to see the number of people that just walk. That's all they do. Mm-hmm. Just walk back and forth. I mean, they don't, you know, or roller skate, roller blade, or ride a bike. You know, it's just not something that I would have ever expected, because I lived the old pier and I remember, it's just brutally hot. And even when the weather's hot, they still go out there. There's places to stop. And so the idea of the coastal thicket was to introduce a different way to get out there and to bring some of the, just a sense of, you know, what a boardwalk in a nature preserve is like with the elements in the landscaping in Florida. That was their idea. And, you know, it was really such a joy to work with, you know, these bright, just brilliant people. W Architecture was the landscape architect for the approach. And her ideas were, Barbara Wilkes, she was more organic. She was more, you know, looked at things differently than the pier guys did, yet they came together very well. And, you know, she designed the gardens along the near the entrance. And she designed the water features, and she designed, you know, the stormwater impacts of it. The playground, she created that hill that nestles the playground so that you could create this little enclave there, keeping some of those native trees. So a lot of really good, smart people worked on this project.
Well, and it's exciting to go out there and see so many different people using it in different ways. You talked about the splash plaid and the playground for kids. The playground alone was $1 million, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, you think of this is not swing sets in a merry-go-round. I mean, then you've got a spa beach for sunbathing, and people can put in kayaks and paddle boards there. You've got public art, you've got dining, you've got the native plants for folks like myself, just the walkers and the bikers. And we should all mention, this is free. You know, this is not like a gated access or anything like that. So free, safe, open at night, great lighting, all that kind of thing. And then you mentioned before this Tampa Bay Watch Discovery Center with the wet classroom, which tells the story of Tampa Bay's complex estuary and Tampa Bay Watch's role into that. You mentioned a little bit about how they were incorporated, and they actually do eco tours out of there as well. So highlight a little bit more that educational feature, because it's almost like an aquarium inside or an educational center, a learning center inside of a pier.
So that was one of the elements that did come out of the community. All the way, leading back all the way to the task force, they felt that there needed to be an educational component, and there needed to be an environmental educational component. So when we looked at the facility, we really thought that there could be no better organization than Tampa Bay Watch that could run it, could operate it, could fit it out, and really make it become what it could be. And Peter Clark and his team just have done a phenomenal job. You mentioned the eco boat and other things. So they just do it programmatically. They do a lot of things, summer camps, and it's a great spot in the middle of the pier where you could basically get a sense of everything around it. The wet classroom overlooks some of the pylons of the original pier that we kept. And I've walked out there sometimes in low tide and just on either side of the bridge and looking down at the water, and it feels like I'm in an aquarium. I'm looking down at an aquarium. So they are really such an important part of the whole project, and just, really puts a stamp on this environmental aspect of this project. Another component that we really haven't talked about is the art. The public art was essential to this project. And we have three significant pieces of public art that were part of the city's public art commission work. One at the very entry to the building, which is an origami pelican, which really begins this very fun type of, look at the pier and kind of plays on itself a little bit. And then these realistic pelicans that are perched on top of it. Mm-hmm. That's an artist named Nathan Mabry out of California. And then there's halfway along the pier, there's a mosaic wall. Zenobia Bailey out of California did this beautiful wall of mosaics kind of midway to the pier. And at the end, there's a piece right at the pier head at the very base of the pier, which is his name escapes me now, but it's a Belgian artist that created this sculpture that's really unique. It almost looks like a splash of water that hits the ground. So it's a lot of great art. And then there was the art with Janet Eckelman, the net sculpture. That was something that Mayor Kreisman wanted to see if it would work here. We did a lot of studies and trying to work a place that it might work. We were looking at putting it at Spa Beach at the tip. And as we looked at those options, again, we heard from the community. They really wanted to preserve the openness of the views at that location. So we tried to integrate it into the project itself. And we were well into construction when we did that, which caused some major redesign and some major effort. But Janet Eckelman was great. She conceived of it a little differently than she had if it had been in a different location. It's her largest piece. It's a double net. We had to engineer the pylons that hold it up, and it became a major part of the project, and trying to integrate that into everything else was a challenge. And then there's the market structures, which one of the things that was the vision of W Architecture was really you wanted to connect to the city.
Yeah.
And those structures were designed by a local architecture firm, Wanamaker Jensen, here in St. Pete. It's basically providing shade for the opportunities to create tents and, this animated market that pops up every weekend and really makes this connection to the city. So you had that. Then you had Doc Ford's, the restaurant.
I was going to ask you about that. Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
The Doc Ford's, what an amazing group. They've just been great to work with. And they have really a premier corner in all of probably the West Coast of Florida. We built slips so you could bring your boat, dock your boat there. There's always, there's just a great environment right in that corner where you can see the planes take off at Albert Witted or the boats coming into the marina, or just a nice place to sit in the shade and have a drink. So they became an anchor for us. And at the pier head, there's a tenant that's got three locations there, the Driftwood Cafe on the ground, the Teak restaurant in the middle, and the Tiki Bar at the top. And at the top, you get these unbelievable views back at the city day and night with the breezes over the water and the fishing platform. So, again, it's just this world of activities and things to do. And it's put St. Pete on the map. I mean, I don't know if Chris Balester, who's the operations manager, has done economic modeling and studies. And what he has received is that this pier has an economic impact of 1.25 million annually. And there's 2.3 million people that have gone through the pier each year since it opened. And we opened in the middle of a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just the acceptance from the community just blown me away. It's been something that, you know, after so many years of effort and trial and trying to figure out, well, how do we do this? What do we do? Are we going to do it right? I think we really did. We knocked it out of the park, and we're just also proud of it. And it took a lot of people. The mayor's office was phenomenal. The deputy mayor, Kanika Tomlin, who led our team the whole way. Every city department worked on this project. We had so many, you know, people that really wanted to make this right. And, you know, we're just all so proud of it.
Okay. Doc Fords is what I was going to ask about. Yeah. So
I knew Doc Fords would be of interest to you, Craig. But give people the origin story of the name Doc Ford.
Doc Ford is from the character created by Randy Wayne White in a series of novels about a retired spy who has moved to Sanibel, which is where a lot of retired spies from the CIA go. And he's set up as a marine biologist there, and he gets yanked back into troubleshooting by various friends and other things that pop up. And so the books are very popular. Randy created the restaurant to go with it there in Sanibel. And I think this is the second location for the Doc Ford's restaurants. And I've heard really good things about the food. I haven't tried it myself, but I hear it's really good.
The whole project is out of this world. Like I said, I've been fortunate enough to visit and get to travel all over the country. There's nothing else like it. There are a lot of wonderful river walks. There are no piers like this P-E-I-R-S and P-E-E-R-S.
So you're saying there's no pier to the pier.
Right. You've got it. Now we've got a good wordplay there too. And yeah. The pot. But I love that seamless integration you talk about with the city, because you've got the St. Petersburg Museum of History right there, the Museum of Fine Arts St. Peter's right there, your walking distance to the James Museum, the Dalí, the great, vibrant, lively dining, shopping, museum area that has sprouted up downtown comes seamlessly onto the pier. It's a fantastic job. Congratulations on it. Thanks for all your work. Raul Quintana, the city architect for St. Petersburg, thanks for joining us today and showing us, telling us how the sausage was made with this wonderful St. Pete Pier.
My pleasure, guys. Really appreciate it.
When my kids were younger, mm-hmm. you know, I'm obviously my wife and I got married at the old pier. But mm-hmm. when my kids were younger, a good day out, a free day out, was to take them to the old pier. There was a small aquarium in there that we could visit. And then for a while, there was a pirate ship that was anchored at the pier. Mm-hmm. It was a reproduction of the HMS Bounty. And the kids could explore the ship from stem to stern, literally. Mm-hmm. And there was a treasure chest down in the hold. And if you open the treasure chest, inside was licorice. So they thought that was a big deal. And, you know, they'd wear their little eye patches and little pirate costumes and stuff and go around there. That ship later shows up in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie in the very beginning of that. And there was also, this is not something you would normally know, but they apparently filmed a porn movie on board that ship too.
Oh my.
And city officials were not happy when they found out about that. But, you know, welcome to Florida.
Yeah, welcome to Florida and welcome to the St. Pete Pier.